You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes. Hollywood might be dreamy, but shooting a low-budget independent film in New York City can easily turn into a nightmare. This is what happens in Tom DiCillo's 1995 film, Living in Oblivion, which follows the cast and crew of an independent movie. The film depicts a series of dreams, starting with the directors, Nick Rev, played by Steve Buscemi, followed by the main actresses, Nicole, played by Catherine Keener, and concluding with an apple and a mysterious dwarf. Living in Oblivion depicts the multiple frustrations that arise during a film shoot, portraying a lovable group of characters doing their very best to make this film a success, and mostly failing. Both atmospheric and hilarious, the film reveals what takes place behind the scenes and how challenging it can be to get just the right take.
Tom DiCillo is one of the founding members of the American independent film movement that began in New York City in the late 1970s. He has written and directed six feature films, helping introduce Brad Pitt, Catherine Keener, Sam Rockwell, and Peter Dinklage to the world. Tom is also a musician and has just released his second album called Shot of Blue.
Tom DiCillo, welcome to After Images podcast. We're delighted to have you with us today for a discussion of your work and especially Living in Oblivion.
Well, I'm delighted to be here too, Marisa. So thank you for inviting me.
Our pleasure. So we usually like to start off with a very basic question, but one that is deceptively simple, and that is, why did you suggest discussing Living in Oblivion? What does it mean to you within your larger filmography and artistic career?
Well, that is a great question, and I thought about that because I was just talking about it to somebody the other day, and the film, the making of the film, the origin of the film contains so many miracles that it has become for me the epitome of just the miracle of filmmaking. And I, you know, I'm not the first one who said this, but it is actually a miracle that any movie ever gets made. Hmm. Any movie, you know. But the film, I mean, so you tell me, how long would you like me to go into detail about that answer, Marisa?
Oh, I mean, we've got time and we love meaty answers here. So.
All right. I will try to kind of sketch out the story of Living in Oblivion. You know, Johnny Suede was my first film, and that took 4 years to get made. It played in theaters in the United States for about a week and disappeared. No one really knew what to make of it. It was distributed by Miramax, and I got a phone call one night right before the film opened from Harvey Weinstein, saying to me, Tom, I'm really sorry. I said, about what? He said, the New York Times review just came out and it's not good. And I'm sorry. I said, well, that's just one review. He goes, yes, Tom, you'll see what I mean. And what he meant was that that was it. They weren't going to promote the film in any way. So that's what happened. Which had this is why this business is so intense. It had a snowball effect on my next project, which was to be Box of Moonlight. I had the script all written, and because of what happened with Johnny Suede, the financing fell apart. Hmm. But I kept working on it and working, trying to find it again. And I got to a point where I use this term that I was between the two sides, right? Homicide and suicide. Those are the two sides I was in. Mm-hmm. And one night, my wife and I got invited to her cousin's wedding in the midst of all this. And we decided to just go and forget things and have a good time. And so I began drinking martinis at the wedding. And I had never had a martini. The first one was so incredible that I had three. And I was almost literally blind drunk at this wedding. Out of the shadow, it was at night, out of the shadows comes this guy, and he comes up to me. And he goes, "Tom, do you remember me?" And he was a guy that I knew from an acting class 5 years earlier. You know, I said, "Yeah, how you doing?" You know, he says, "Oh man, you're so lucky. You got to make a movie. Johnny Suede, lights, camera, action." That's what he said. Well, it was the perfect opportunity for me to vent. And so I did on this poor guy. I did. I said, "Can I swear? Can I swear on your podcast?"
And yes, to your heart's delight.
I said, "Shut the fuck up. You don't know the first thing about what it's like to make a movie. Be on, let's say you're lucky enough to get on set. You're actually there and you have film in the camera and you're actually shooting. The actor, the actress could be in the middle of the most incredibly emotional moment, which is a rarity, and something happens. A boom comes into the shot. A truck drives by, whatever." I actually stopped and went, "That's an idea. That's an idea. I could make a half an hour movie just about that, just about trying to get a shot and let that stuff happen. The boom drop in the frame, the confusion between the crew." And so I'm telling you, I went home that weekend and I wrote the first half hour in 3 days. It flowed so like miraculously. That was the first miracle. Well, no, the first miracle was that guy running into me. And I actually gave him a part in the movie. He plays the guy that hits the sticks. I wrote the first half hour. Catherine Keener was visiting us. And I said, "Here, why don't you read this?" And she read it. I'm telling you, the laughter that came from the room where she was sitting was just unbelievable. She said, "We have to do this. We have to do this." She gave it to her husband, Dermot. And Dermot immediately put up $5,000. He said, "I'd like to play the director." I said, "Well, listen, I really like your $5,000, but why don't you play the cameraman?" He goes, "Okay." And he goes, "What about Steve Buscemi for the director?" I said, "That's a great idea." That's how Steve got cast. The next thing I know, we had $37,000. We raised it in about a week and a half, and I was shooting a movie. When I mean, and completely out of the realm of any way I ever thought I would make a movie. There was no real purpose to it. I wasn't trying to get it anywhere. This was just solely to do it, you know? And so we shot the first half hour and it went so amazing. At the end of the shoot, the actors were all walking around depressed. And I said, "What's the matter?" And they said, "It's just, we don't want this to end. We don't want it to end. You have to make a feature out of this." I went, "Forget it, forget it. There's no way it's a half an hour movie, you know?" And then I started trying to get the film out there as a half an hour film. And you know what? I realized that most festivals don't want a film that's a half an hour. They just it's not in any category that they can show. So I began to think, you know what? Maybe I have to make a feature out of it. So I sat down and just very carefully began thinking, well, what could happen in part two? What did I learn from part one that could go into part two? And I said, well, there seems to be a relationship between the director and the lead actress. I said, okay, that's interesting. I said, what if the cameraman is actually in a relationship with the first AD? That could be another interesting relationship. And that's what prompted it. Plus, the central idea was that I really wanted to put on film a director and his lead actor getting into a fist fight. So I had part two, and all right, so here, that was a miracle. All right, so here's one of the most amazing miracles. I was sitting on the couch one afternoon thinking, okay, I have part one, I got part two. What could part three be about? And my wife was eating lunch in the other room, and I was complaining to her about how difficult it all was. She took a bite of her sandwich and she said, part one is a dream. Part two is a dream. Why don't you make part three them sh shooting a dream sequence? Instantly, I had this idea of a dwarf getting furious that he was cast in a dream sequence. And so that miracle pulled part three in. There's so many other miracles that I could go into, but I won't, except to tell you that I tried to then take this now a feature concept with the first half hour already shot. People could really see what it was, right? I took it to all the US distributors and financiers, and they all passed on it. They all passed on it. I met some guy, some sleazy Hollywood guy, who said he wanted to do it, but he was gonna like be involved with it in every way. He was gonna do the casting and all this. And I just went, well, I have no other option. So I might have to take this offer. And just then, my phone, I was on the phone with him, my call waiting clicked in, and it was the guy that I met at the wedding, right? His wife were on the phone. He and his wife were on the phone, and they said, "Listen," and they both were in the film. She played the script girl, and she goes, "Listen, Tom, I we hate to bother you." I said, "Yeah, listen, I'm on a very important phone call right now." She says, "Listen, sorry to bother you, but we were wondering." We have some money, and we were wondering, would you let us finance your film? I said, hold on a second. Got the guy on the other line, and I said, listen, take your money, you're producing crap, and get the hell out of here. I'm done. And so they came in, they produced the film, and that was one of the most incredible miracles, because it enabled us to shoot the film without any interference from anybody. No producers, no agents, nothing. It was just the actors and me and the crew. They all came back. This was a year after we had shot the first part. And they all came back. We were in a tiny space in New York City for 15 days. We shot the whole rest of the film in 15 days. And anyway, that's the story in a nutshell, Marissa.
It's so incredible, and it must have felt very fortifying after all of the difficulties that you faced. And I imagine
Was.
you look back on that time as a very precious one.
It was. And it was. And again, just so many things fell into place. Nobody auditioned for a single part except for one person, and that was Peter Dinklage. Because I realized very quickly that I couldn't just put a small person in that role. I needed someone who was a really good actor. And his name came up, and he had done nothing, literally nothing. And so, I met him. And I said, "This guy's a good actor," and that's how he was cast. But consider, I never knew what James LeGros as Chad Palomino was going to do. Never. He said, "Yes, I'll be in it." So he shows up, and usually when you cast a movie, if it's it seems so important to you that you almost agonize about every role. Do I have the right actor? In this case. They all look, and look how brilliant they all were. That's just incredible.
I really like the irony of a film in which dream is so central, depicting the dark side of the Hollywood dream itself. And it seems to me that dreams are an element that come on a regular basis in your filmography. I think that there's a dream sequence in almost all your films. Can you tell us something about your relationship to dreams and to the way that they relate to the rest of the story?
Yeah, that's a good point, Frank. Well, you know, the master of the cinematic dream is, of course, Buñuel. You know, the way he can get you into a dream and you don't really even know that you're in it, which is the way we all dream. Do you understand what I'm saying? When
Yes.
we dream, we don't, there isn't pink smoke, there isn't crazy music, there are no dwarfs. And yet, that's why dreams affect us so much, because when they're happening to us, we really think it's happening. There's no sign that's going, okay, by the way, this is just a dream. No, it's your subconscious playing with you all night long. And that ability to get in and out of a dream without pointing a finger at it, I think is one of the real powers specific to film. I think only film can do that. I mean, I suppose a book could, a novel, right? But the images of film lend themselves to the more power, I think, of that. There's dreams are so revealing too. There are no lies in a dream. Right?
It's even the contrary. I mean, you know, the dreams in the film, in the first part and in the second part of Living in Oblivion, they leave little hints about what's going to happen later in the story, don't they?
Yes, they do. Yes. It's just I love it. It's just a way to take the viewer on a journey, and some of my favorite films do that. I mean, even starting with like The Wizard of Oz, which I think holds up as one of America's greatest cinematic achievements, you know. But how she goes into a dream. The whole film is a dream. You know, but so detailed, you know. And the other thing that it made me realize, and I'll just say this as a side thing, dream is something that is universal to every single person. And when you think about it, we each write, direct, shoot, right? Light and act in a movie every single time we dream, because it's all coming from us. So even the way the dreams proceed in terms of time is edited by you night. You know what I'm saying? So the length of the shots in a dream come from you. It's a really phenomenal, you know, thing.
And the film is very good, I think, at communicating the altered state of consciousness that follows a dream or that one feels within a dream. When you watch the film, there is a little something, though, because also it is mostly shot at night, that puts you in a very dreamy atmosphere.
Right. Well, you know, ultimately, you kind of realize that if you have any sort of perception, sometimes just life itself can seem like a dream. You know, the conflicts that come up, like for example, in Living in Oblivion. You know, the fact that Steve is humiliated and almost destroyed in front of the entire crew. You know, and when this guy says to him, "This is this, you know, the, I'm not, this is, I'm out of here. This is a stupid movie. I shouldn't, you know." That's heavy, you know, and he, you know, that's like something happening to you in a dream. It hits you really, really, really strong.
Especially, I mean, if I might add a little something, Marisa, because it is directly related to his film, that is to say, to his own dream.
Right.
Which I think is also interesting because this is also what you were experiencing at the time, isn't it?
Right. Yes.
And I'm so glad that you mentioned The Wizard of Oz, because I was thinking a lot about your use of black and white and color, and how when the film opens, we assume that this might be reality on a set, and it's black and white, and it takes us, of course, time to realize that someone is having a dream. Can you talk a little bit about that? Was that directly inspired by The
Yes,
Wizard
it
of Oz?
was. And again, just remember that the first half hour was conceived as only going to be that. So it made total sense to me to have the gritty reality of the set, people sweating and whatever, yelling, would be black and white. And so whenever the camera rolled, then it would cut to color, just like they do in The Wizard of Oz. That was an inspiration. But then once I wrote part two and part three, I was faced with a challenge, which was how to proceed. And I decided that what I would do was flip it and have reality be in color and the shooting be in black and white, almost like a throwback to those really classic Hollywood movies, the 40s and the 30s, which were really gorgeous. I mean, when you see some of those movies like Philadelphia Story or even The Asphalt Jungle, that black and white is its own really incredible world. So that worked. And then I decided that with the last part, I would keep it all color, that everything would just be what it is.
And I'm also really curious, if I may, to know a little bit more about generally how you work with actors, but particularly on this film, because it speaks so much to their own experiences. I imagine everyone's experiences on set of that kind of tension between frustration and comedic absurdity that happens on a film set. So could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, I will say that one of the smartest things I ever did was after I got out of film school, I had a degree in directing, right? They give you sort of some general acting classes and things like that, but I mean, I'm telling you, nothing made any impression on me, and I knew that when I got out of film school that, you know what, if I'm going to keep doing this, I need to understand what acting is. And I started taking a class as an observer in an acting class. And one day the teacher said to me, "Why don't you come up and do a scene?" I was terrified, but I did it. And he actually said, "You know what? You've got something. That's I would encourage you to keep investigating it." And it started me on this 8-year journey of just acting and studying acting. And I learned so much. Some of the best acting I've ever seen has been in an acting class where and it took a very special teacher to do that. And what I was doing was watching these teachers, how they would speak to actors, to the students. In very rare cases did I ever see a teacher say, "That's terrible. What are you doing? That's awful. That was stupid." Never once did I see that. The only time I saw that was on the set of movies that I experienced. And I said, "Tom, you have to figure out how to utilize that on your own movies." And so that respect for the actor, the understanding that as soon as they walk out, and here's the camera, the lights, everybody's, they're the ones that are responsible for bringing this rare flicker of truth and emotion to the film. And if they don't, you don't have a movie. And so I found that one of the most, I think, productive things I did with actors was never speak out loud to them on the set. I would always just take them aside privately and whisper something to them. That only they would know. And I would gauge their response to it. If it was something that they didn't, react to, then I would say, "Okay, let's try something else." But usually, let's say in the case of Steve Buscemi or Catherine Keener, they just love that. And because my respect for them was so great, I didn't ask them to do anything that was ridiculous, and so with Living in Oblivion, it was relatively effortless. Again, the idea that many times I would take either one of the actors or two of them aside and just whisper something to them that only they knew, and to bring to a scene, which would then surprise the other actor. And when you get that live sort of surprise, then something alive starts to happen, in front of you. And I think with Steve, I said one thing to him. He's in the first part where he's looking at the rehearsal in which the camera's not running, right? I barely had to even make any real suggestion there. But I said, listen, you know what? The agony of not having the camera rolling is not also going to stop you from appreciating what you're seeing. So if you look at what Steve does in that scene, you see his fury and his agony of that, the fact that it's not happening, but you also see his eyes going, oh my God, look how incredible this is. But I just, listen, I do believe that in general, but particularly with actors, if you can get their imagination going, right? So in other words, they're thinking on their own. Then your work becomes so much easier. And that's really what you want. You don't want it to be like you're pulling teeth on the set. You want it to be the opposite, that it's like that something's coming from the actor that it's exciting them.
It seems to me that this is even more important in your films because there is so much comedy in them, and that it has to have the right tempo, the right it needs to function like clockwork. And it seems to me that it does function perfectly in this film, among others in your filmography, this very and sharp action reaction between the actors, that is the result of the relationship you've built with them, isn't it?
There was a phrase in one of my acting classes. Do you know what the word pinch means? Pinch, to pinch, right? That's a pinch, right? And then the reaction is the ouch. Ouch, ouch, right? Well, if you can get that going, right, between two actors, then something just really living starts to happen in front of you. And I've always been just amazed by, like particularly the films of Fellini, the way the acting is, and I do believe that that was because they all trusted him, they trusted him, and he was very generous on the set to his actors, I believe, but yeah.
And speaking of trust, perhaps you could say a word about the fact that, you have actors with whom you've collaborated multiple times. And I'm wondering also how that affected your process of directing, because I imagine that there's a special friendship and trust that, expands over time when that happens.
Yes, that's a great observation, Marissa. Being on the set is a very intense experience, and at times you can feel completely alone, especially if you're struggling with a scene and it's not going right, and or there's tension or something, and you it's a it can be a very lonely and disturbing place to be. And I found that when you have collaborators that share your vision and share your commitment, then it becomes like a home in a way. There's a kind of security and a comfort and a recognition that you're among allies. And you always want to feel that. And that's an environment I like to create on the set. That people feel respected. Everybody feels respected, from the guy who just brings in the cable to every and and I've just seen that happen a million times, that it affects the mood, it affects the entire creative level of the set, and it's a very fragile environment, and I wanted to show how fragile it was by simply letting the two people that show up first for the for the shoot in the morning, in the beginning of the film, are these craft these food the food people, right? And they're exhausted. They're probably not making any money, you know. And then suddenly they notice that the milk just might be not right, you know. But they're tired. It's like 4 in the morning. What are they gonna do? You know, they leave it. They leave the bad milk out, and it ultimately comes to affect the entire shoot because Wolf keeps drinking it, and he's in the bathroom when the only real acting moment happens, and that's actually my belief, just how fragile it is, and what we're trying to do on the set is really a miracle, which is. You know, trying to bring something alive in front of the camera. And it's a rarity, and I respect it.
But this example of the milk, I think, is very interesting because it shows how, when you write your scripts, you do a lot of foreshadowing of elements that are going to happen later. I mean, at first, when we see them talking about the milk, it's very fast. Leaves our consciousness, but it comes back later and has a tremendous influence. And I was comparing this with Box of Moonlight, with the camera that goes up at the beginning of the film to show us the circle sign of the rental car. And then you find out that the whole film is itself a circle, cyclical.
That's a good point. I'm glad you mentioned that, bro. Yeah, I thought a long time about that because I had to choose the title of the company. I mean, I wrote that, so I said, "Well, what could it be?" And then, you know, it seemed like it actually that would be the title of a rental car, you know, company without any symbolism. It could actually be that way. But even like Nick in the in Living in Oblivion, you know, his last name.
Rev. Indeed, for people who don't speak French, that means dream, which is of course very symbolic and lets you find out what's happening afterward. And I was wondering too if, I mean, he's Nick and she's Nicole, so I was wondering if there was something of a mirror image between the
A
two of
little
them.
bit. Yes, there yes, there was.
And beyond that, I know that in England, they call the devil Old Nick. So I was wondering if there might be something of of that as well, because then there's the scene with the apple being beaten, as in the Garden of Eden. So, or is it just me putting too much in the
That might be a little bit of you, Frank.
Yes.
Was just I just like to, you know. When you have dialogue with characters, you know, especially with their names, their names are important to me. And I just like the way the word Nick just comes out. Nick, are you ready, Nick? You know, it's just I just like the way it sounded. That's
And I'm wondering too, because as funny as the films are, there are so many grains of truth that almost mirror the idea of a morality tale. Is that a label that you would feel comfortable with, or do you feel like that's going too far?
Well, I would say perhaps, you know, fable is a really powerful thing, you know, and I particularly responded to the original fables of the Grimm's fairy tales. Even Aesop's fables have a strange humor to them, that's sly and intelligent and not stupid. You know, I think people sometimes use the word fable, you know, in a bad way. Like it's changed its meaning. It's become something that actually means false. When in actuality, fables are really one of the precursors of dream interest because you're operating in a world that is not a human world. It's not a real world. You know, animals talk. You know, just strange stuff happens. But
A wolf talks in your film.
yes. But the only thing I would leave out of the morality tale, Marissa, is the morality, because if my films are fables, I think they have a little bit of Kafka in them, you know. just the existential idea of I suppose, I mean, there, I think characters in my films struggle with what's the right thing to do, you know, and they come up against that sometimes when they don't, and the struggle of trying to do the right thing. I think that's always an interesting thing to have in any story or any piece of art, is a conflict where someone isn't perfect. You know, I hate movies where someone is just so good, they're always good, or they're just all bad. I mean, that's not life. Life is not that way.
But I think that's what's so strong in your filmography, because right from the outset, Johnny Suede is such a perfect example of that. He's this almost kind of ambiguous character, because I neither hate him nor love him. I can see how selfish he is at times and uncaring or immature. But at the same time, there's this real humanity in him, and there's this artistic longing that we can really empathize with. And yeah, great character.
Well, that was tough because audiences have a tough time with that. They wanted him to be one way, and I think that's one of the issues that I struggled with having audience reactions to that film. They didn't quite understand how could this guy be a rock star? Look at him, he's a fool. And I said, that's right. That's exactly what he is. He's a fool, and he doesn't know what he's doing. You know, I don't think I've ever seen, and I'm just saying this, and this is a scene that's actually overlooked quite a bit in Johnny Suede, or a theme that's overlooked. It is Catherine Keener's character, Yvonne, that instructs Johnny in one of the most basic principles of sexuality that he knew nothing about. He didn't even know. I mean, I don't think I have seen that in a movie where that is something as simple as that just happens. Oh, and she didn't laugh at him, you know, she did, but she just goes, I don't know what you're doing.
That's not
Right,
it.
that's right. And so that was one of my favorite scenes in the film, and they both handled that. Brad and Catherine handled that so beautifully.
Because the character is very narcissistic, but at the same time, as in all fairy tales, I think that he evolves and he learns as the movie progresses. And I think this is also something that one finds in other movies of yours. To me, anyway, Delirious is a fairy tale, a total fairy tale about finding a princess in a castle, and being the knight who slowly goes through the various steps in order to reach her. And he too learns along the way, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. But again, it's also got a duality to it, because Steve Buscemi's character in Delirious was to be what in English we call the troll. Do you know what a troll, like the creature under the bridge that, you know, tricks someone, right? And they're always like, they look like they live under the bridge. That's a great character in Fables. So he's like the troll. He snares Toby, so to speak, you know. And so we designed his whole apartment to look like something that was, you know, almost underground, right? But again, you know, his character has something that is, for me, I just love the duality in his Les Galantine, because I gave him that name, Galantine. Like, there's something gallant about him, even though he's a creep. You know, and he actually, his heart is enormous in Delirious.
I'm wondering if, because I want to make sure that we have enough time to discuss this, I wonder if you might talk about music. You yourself are an accomplished musician. You've recorded multiple albums, and music is very central throughout your filmography in different ways. So could you tell us maybe just a little bit about where this interest in music comes from? Did you grow up studying music?
No, I didn't. I stumbled into it. But thank you for recognizing that. I mean, I would not say I'm accomplished. I have a I have a knack for a simple kind of chord structures and progressions and things like that. And I like to write lyrics, so I think I have a skill there as well. But my brother, I had an older brother who insisted on getting a guitar when he was around 14, and he just couldn't play it. And it went into his closet and stayed there for about 5 years. And one day I just saw it in the closet and I picked it up. And I didn't even know how to tune it, but I found a way to tune it. And I just started playing it. And I just continued. I liked it. I just felt there was something about music that really felt part of me. And so I just kept playing, and I eventually took a few lessons, nothing too serious. When Johnny Suede came around, I found that I had written these like three sort of nonsense songs, very simple chord structures, but real with nonsense lyrics. I mean, lyrics that somebody who was just starting out might write, and I have to tell you, it takes a special skill to be able to write something that's kind of stupid. I'll just tell you a quick story because a real accomplished musician, Nick Cave, called me one night out of the blue from Berlin. He had seen my script on a friend's night table and read it for Johnny Suede. And he called me and said, "Listen, I'd like to play Freak Storm in Johnny Suede." I said, "You got it. You can do it," because I had such respect for him as a musician, And so once it was all done and everything, I mean, that he was going to be in it, he wrote me a note. And he said, "Listen, that song that I'm supposed to sing, Mama's Boy, he said it's kind of stupid." I said, "Yeah, it is, Nick. It's supposed to be." And he said, "Do you mind if I make a pass at the lyrics?" I said, "Go for it, do it." Right. About 3 weeks later, this cassette tape arrives in the mail, and it's Nick singing his lyrics to Mama's Boy. And they were the heaviest, darkest, just like completely off what, and then there's this sigh. I'm listening to this tape thinking, what am I going to say to him? How am I going to say this? It's quiet. And then suddenly I hear him say, "It's home. I think we'll give a few lyrics. Mine are even stupider than yours." So that's how, my song ended up in Johnny Suede. But I was so pleased that I put some music in film. And I've always just been amazed at the power of music and film. When it works well, when it's, you can't hardly tell the difference of what's what, music and film in a sequence. It's so powerful. It's so powerful. And it's frequently abused to the sense that if somebody wants like an emotional scene, they'll put emotional music on it. Well, or crazy, crazy scene, crazy music, but I just, for me, when it comes time to do that in a scene, it is the most exciting because you never know what's going to happen when you lay a piece of music in on a sequence. You never know. And I've always been blown away by something that really, really works. And so, when they called me to do the Doors movie, the documentary about the Doors, I was thrilled because it enabled me to really use whatever my own limited understanding of music is, to talk about how these four guys put that specific sound together. But I love putting music in film, and I love playing it, so.
I think that the naive quality of the lyrics in Johnny Suede works perfectly with the film. I mean, it really is exactly what was needed by the character. And it's so beautiful, actually. I don't know if you would agree with that, but I see echoes of David Lynch in you. I see the same interest for naive lyrics to beautiful music, the interest for dreams, the interest for the 1950s and weird Americana. Right. Am I right in seeing maybe some resonances there?
Yes, I mean, David Lynch was a huge influence. I mean, I have such respect for him as a filmmaker, even though I don't get into all of his movies. I believe that he is unique in that he has created his own cinema language. That is particular to him. Now, who else can say that? Who else can say that? He's come up with his own way of giving information in a film, and it constantly surprises you and intrigues you and keeps you interested. You don't quite know where you are all the time, but you know you're somewhere. And he has also a kind of a goofy quality. He has a goofy quality that I respond to. He's not so intensely serious all the time.
I totally agree. This is definitely one aspect of David Lynch that is understudied. The humor that he has in some of his films, and I can see a lot in common with the way you do some of your humor too there.
Well, I must confess that his use of the dwarf was one of my motivations for the soliloquy that Tito says. You know, is this the only way you can make this seem like a dream? Put a dwarf in it? I don't even have dreams with dwarfs in them.
I was wondering because it was just a few years after Twin Peaks, right?
Yes.
It's perfect.
But I think in terms of music, what I really appreciate is the diverse facets that takes throughout your filmography. You have musicians who act in your films. There is music that's been written playing within the fictional films, fantastic soundtracks leading up to the wonderful Doors documentary. And for that one, what I appreciate so much is the way that you've got the film, you bring the filmmaker's sensitivity to Morrison's filmmaking angle, which I think is really underappreciated. And I was just so shocked to read that people thought you had used a stand-in for Morrison.
Oh, Morrison.
And they didn't even know about these films that exist. And it was such a beautiful gift to share that with us.
That was, I would say, one of the most disturbing experiences of my film career, seeing that happen. And it was relentless. People refused to believe it, even when I presented them with evidence. All that footage was, when they approached me, I said, listen, you know, they said they have all this footage of the band, you know. And so I said, well, the first thing I need to do, they were insistent that I give them a concept. What's your concept? I said, well, you know what? I don't really know yet. Let's send me all the footage. So they did. And in the middle of these boxes of stuff was sometimes this footage of Morrison walking down a highway. And I had seen really bad duplications of that on the internet, but didn't really know what it was from. And it was only then that I began researching and found out that Jim had made his own movie. He had financed it himself. He had insisted that they shoot 35 millimeter negative. And this film was called Highway, HWY. And for the longest time, and so ultimately, another miracle that happened to me was somehow coming up with the concept, which was one night I was just sitting there looking at this silent footage, and there was a shot of Jim in his car, fiddling with the radio, but nothing. I mean, in the actual film, I think there's something that comes on, but I'm not sure what it was. But then there's this shot of him from the side, and it just looked like he was in a very strange existential space emotionally. And suddenly I said, what if? What if he turns on that radio and he hears the announcement of his own death? And that this driving, this wandering is him trying to find meaning as to what was this whole moment in America about. So therefore, this footage became very important. And the only thing available to me was these really bad copies of copies of copies, sometimes even with like big chunks cut out of them. And it bothered me because it's the only thing I had, but it's what I used. And so the film was cut with all of this really bad footage. And I'm telling you, a week before the film was to be finished, I was presented with a mysterious phone call saying, we have located the original negative of Highway. Would you like to use it? I said, yes, I would. They said, there's one stipulation. I'm going to say this, okay? You cannot make any reference in the film to Pamela Corson's drug use, what led to her death, any of that stuff. You cannot. And that was tough because in the researching of the film, it was so obvious she was a heroin addict. It's one of the reasons they went to Paris. She knew this count that was supplying heroin to almost all of America's rock stars at that time. It was her, and she died of a heroin overdose. I saw the police report. I saw it. Now, I didn't put that in the film, but I also had mentioned something about her own drug use, right? And this contact said, you can have the footage if you take that out. And so I weighed. I really was a very heavy, heavy choice. And I ultimately said, you know what? The film is more about the Doors than it is about this woman. So I got it. I cut it in. It looks. I mean, when you saw the first image of this just completely pristine film, you couldn't even believe it. And so I just thought, oh my God, how happy people are going to be to see that. Suddenly, the first thing we had a screening, and someone said, who'd you get to play Jim Morrison? I said, what are you talking about? First of all, you know what it shows you? It shows you that people think they know things that they don't know anything. People think that they know Jim Morrison. If they really knew Jim Morrison, then they would know that that was him. It's so obvious.
Obviously him, and that information about his filmmaking has been available for a long time, so they
I
should
agree.
know.
And they didn't even, so the film showed it at Sundance, right? And there was a distributor there that I had really wanted to see the film. And I was sitting behind him, actually. And suddenly, after 5 minutes, he gets up and storms out. And I ran out after him. I said, what are you doing? What's the matter? He goes, I can't believe you used a stunt double in this film. I said, it's not. It's from Jim's own film. You can see it anywhere. And he looked at me like I was playing some really horrible trick on him and still walked off and passed on the film. Even major critics that I said, listen, you should just check this. Go here, check your source, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Also, I said, I wouldn't have minded just a little bit of checking with me first because they wrote this in their reviews before they even asked me. They put it in their review. It was publicized. And I recently did a post on my website in which I took the actual frames that were deteriorated and really messed up that had been on the internet since 1972, right? And I contrasted them with the exact same frame from my film. I said, listen, okay, do you get it? Do you see what happened here? Anyway, that's, yeah. Marissa, that was disturbing, you know.
Gosh, I can imagine. I'm so sorry that you lived through that because it was such a wonderful cinematic gift to fans of The Doors and Morrison's work. But I really hope that the film has found a new audience because I know it was part of the PBS Masters series, I believe, and that hopefully led to a whole new wave of people discovering the film.
I wouldn't say a whole new way, but people did. Again, my experience with my distributor in that was not great. They didn't. I mean, I thought it would like come out on big screens, you know, with really great Dolby sound. You know, people could, because one thing, if you may notice in the film, I don't use little short snippets of songs. The songs that I had in there, I let them play out, so that you could really, really follow the development of their music. And I thought that would be a great thing to experience in a theater, like you were at a concert, you know.
Absolutely.
But the film did not get a very good theatrical release.
I think that the use of that footage at the beginning is striking. It's very beautiful, and also it really helps portray Jim Morrison in a sort of mythological way. I've got the feeling that he becomes a mythic figure, and with a tragic ending, as with any good myth. I was thinking about your filmography, and it seems to me that there is a recurrence of that motif in your lead male actors, of very charismatic young males who are a bit lost in life and who are evocative, I think, of Jim Morrison. Am I correct in possibly seeing a certain link there?
Maybe. I mean, I think if we just look at, that's a good question. Let me think about it as I try to answer it. Because let's say Sam Rockwell's character in Box of Moonlight is a troubled young man, right? Kind of torn between his grip on illusion. You know, illusion is more, he can't deal with reality, so he lives in a fantasy world. Johnny Swade lives in a fantasy world, you know.
I
But
think in Delirious, there is really something of this, so with the character played by, I forgot his first name,
Michael
Pitt,
Pitt,
Michael
Michael,
Pitt, yes, yeah.
but to me, it's, I guess it's more reflective, perhaps, of my own discovery, self-discovery of myself, and attempts to come to some sort of understanding of what makes me do what I do and who I am, you know, and this idea that there are things that you need to work on in your life, it's not just waking up and being born and just strolling, to the gates of paradise. You have to sometimes really, really struggle with accepting some things about yourself that may not be the easiest to accept or to understand, and then working on them, you know. And to me, I have the greatest respect for people that come to that moment and actually realize that, you know what, they need to do some work, and they do it. You know. So,
And also, I see a lot of links with how art helps in that process. I mean, all of the people in these films are making some form of art or music, and how that plays into the kind of the messiness of the artist's life, the artist's way, intersecting with one's personal development, but in such beautiful ways.
as a tool of self-discovery.
I think art is, for me, it's everything, you know. You know, in some strange way, I find that if I kind of create something every day. I don't even know what it is, but there's just something about the act of creation that is so inspiring to me. Even if it's, I find myself like collecting strange objects, as you know, if I see them on the street, something I find. And so every now and then I'll walk into my office here, and I'll suddenly say, oh, what if I put this next to this? And it makes something, whatever it is, these two strange things. But it's, I think it's a salvation. And I think that I wish that, I mean, I think every human being has the capability of being creative. It may not be musicians, sculptors, or dancers, or whatever, but you can be creative in any other aspect of your life. And if anything, I just feel that society, culture today, is about people with this intense desire to be known for nothing. For absolutely nothing. And I think, really, I think satisfaction can come. You don't have to be known to the entire universe in order to achieve some sort of contentment with your life.
I mean, my feeling is that those people want to be known when they don't even know themselves.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, they think that if someone else knows me, that's the only answer. That's all that matters.
This has been such a wonderful hour with you. We usually like to wrap things up because I have the feeling we could discuss for a week doing
I do too. I must say, it's been really, really fantastic talking to you. I can't even believe that an hour has gone by. That's amazing.
We usually like to conclude with a final question, which turns back to you. Is there a question that you wish we had asked during this time together?
Wow. No, really. I feel that your intuition and perception of what makes me the kind of filmmaker I am, it was expressed to me. And I tell you, there's nothing that is more appreciated by an artist than that. They say, "Oh, yeah, this is what we get about you, Tom." And so I really respected that. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. And
Thank
thank
you
you
so much.
for the
All
wonderful
right.
that you've given us. We're just so appreciative.
Okay. Well, thank you. I will say that one of the best responses to When You're Strange was in France. I had the most incredible time out over there with John Densmore. We were there together promoting the film, and the French distributor did such a wonderful job with it. I'll never forget. In fact, I have it hanging on the wall, a giant subway poster that they was in all of the metro, and I just it bigger than life, and sometimes I contrast that, and I would just end with this, but that just seeing that big poster was, it wasn't so much the size of it was the impact of it. It was the fact that somebody thought, you know what, this deserves to be this big, right? When Johnny Suede, when Living in Oblivion actually opened in New York City, there had been a really wonderful piece in the New York Times about it. I got the opposite experience of my first film, Johnny Suede. The film critic wrote an amazing review of the film. It was incredible, right? That was a week before the film opened. The day the film opened, my friend called me and said, "Hey, I'm sorry I missed your movie." "What are you talking about? It just opened." He goes, "There's nothing in the paper." And I looked, and the only thing that was literally in the paper was an ad this big. Can you see? You could barely read it. You almost had to take a magnifying glass to read it. And the distributor said, "Well, our research has shown that the size of the ad means nothing." Well, first of all, they were liars because the next weekend they opened another movie with an ad that was this big. But the fact that the French distributor did that, and I think it really had an effect because it shows you that they had faith in what they were doing. That they believed in the movie that big. You know what I'm saying?
And your films are really liked here, and
Thank
I think that they do deserve to be advertised that big because
you.
very important filmmaker. And I think that all the people who haven't understood that really don't understand what cinema is all about.
Well, Bronk, thank you so much. Again, it was really great talking to you both.
Fantastic meeting you. Thank you for the generous discussion.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Have a good day.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images Podcast on social media.